As you've probably realized, this topic of emptiness is quite subtle and not so easy to understand, but that's okay. This is something that you'll need to, of course, listen to, reflect on, meditate many, many, many times. So usually what happens, of course, you hear something and you go, I don't understand anything. And then you listen a bit more and you go, oh, now I understand. And then you listen a bit more and you go, oh, I really don't understand. And then you listen more, oh, now I really understand. So if this is your experience, that's good. It means you're really starting to think about it. So that's a good sign. What can be very helpful with this topic of emptiness is that whenever various topics are presented that are not so easy to understand, often in the text or teachings I'll give an analogy, a simple analogy to better understand what we're talking about. And here in the area of emptiness, there are many analogies that are often presented. One that I particularly like and I find very helpful is the analogy of a dream. Now when we're dreaming, in the dream there appears to be an independent subjective dream me and an independent objective dream world out there. And we believe in that dream world, and then when we're faced with pleasant and unpleasant experiences in the dream, we react with attachment, aversion and so forth. But if we become lucid in the dream, so that means, of course, in the middle of the dream, suddenly we realize this is a dream, then, of course, there will still appear to be an independent dream me, and there will still appear to be this independent dream world there. But because we're lucid now, we'll directly realize that these dream appearances are deceiving us. There is no independent dream world, independent dream me. This whole dream landscape is a product of the mind. Which means, of course, the dream doesn't stop, but our perspective of the dream will be completely different. Which means that if we are now faced with pleasant and unpleasant things appearing in our dream, because we're lucid, it actually becomes difficult to react to those with attachment and aversion. And actually what happens is we just end up enjoying the dream a hell of a lot more. This view of emptiness is like a dream, because now this view is saying that we are asleep with ignorance, that in our waking world there appears to be an independent subjective me and an independent objective world there, and when we're faced with pleasant and unpleasant situations we react with attachment, aversion, mental afflictions, big mess. But if we become lucid in our waking world by realizing emptiness, then there will still appear to be an independent me here, an independent world there. But now because we're lucid through realizing emptiness, we will realize this dream world is deceiving us, that the world is not existing as it appears. Which means, of course, the world doesn't disappear. Our perspective of the world now will be completely different. Which means that if we are faced now with some pleasant and unpleasant experience, it becomes very difficult to react with attachment and aversion, because we realize this waking world is also a product of the mind, and actually we'll end up enjoying our daily life much, much more. So this, I think, dream analogy can really be helpful in appreciating what this view of emptiness is really saying. How do we go about practicing it? In that verse, briefly, it says, correctly analyzing meaning of reality, please bless me to generate quickly within my mind stream the unified path of calm abiding and special insight. We're going to answer that briefly by looking at this chart here, this Mahayana path chart. Now, when we, as the text says here, analyzing the meaning of reality, in our investigation, we can investigate any particular thing. But the texts often recommend we start by focusing on ourselves as a person. We investigate the person. Is there really this independent me that seems to be here? And we search for this independent me that seems to be here. And this is what we did in the meditation at the beginning of this evening's session. And so then we search to see, is there this independent me that, you know, that seems to be really here? And we're searching for it. And if we don't manage to find this independent me, then that not finding experience is an experience of emptiness. And then we are to hold that not finding experience as long as we can. Allow it to penetrate deeper into our mind. But of course, at our level, we're not really able, if we get to that experience, we're not really able to hold it very long because our mind is not very stable. We either just space out or get distracted. So if we want that experience of emptiness to really have a much deeper impact on our mind, a more lasting impact, we need to work on our shamatha practice. We need to develop a stable, clear mind. Because if we don't do that, then not only will our emptiness practice not really get very far, none of our other practices will either. You know, if we're trying to do the Tonglen or the loving kindness or impermanence practice or any meditation we're doing, if we don't have a stable, clear mind, then it's going to be difficult to get a taste of anything for it to really penetrate our mind. So we really need to put effort into stabilizing our mind through the shamatha practice. With a more stable mind, then we use that stable, clear mind to investigate. But of course, every time we start to investigate, that sort of disturbs the balance of the mind a bit. And if it does too much, then we need to stop the investigation and go back to stabilizing. So we need to what's called alternate shamatha vipassana. And that's what we're doing as a beginner. And that's what we're doing on the first, I won't go through this whole chart because it's a whole big topic. I just want to point a few things. The first stage of this Mahayana path here, which is called path of accumulation. This is also what we're doing here. We are alternating this shamatha vipassana. We have a very stable, clear mind. We investigate. If it gets unstable too much from investigation, we stop for a while and go back. And so at this point, shamatha and vipassana are not unified, as what's being said here in the text, the unified path. But if you look at, on this chart here down the bottom, there's this number four. Number four says union of calm abiding, special insight, observing emptiness. So that's what the foundation of all good qualities is referring to, is that by this second stage of the path, what's called path of preparation, our analysis, our investigation into reality is now not disturbing our mind, but it's enhancing our concentration. Therefore, shamatha and vipassana become unified. They're now unified, and that is at the second stage of the path, this path of preparation. But up until this point, from the beginning stage right up until this point, when we have this experience of emptiness, in the meditation, there's still a sense of me, the meditator, realizing this thing, emptiness. So there still appears to be this subject-object duality. But on this path of preparation, we are deepening our experience of emptiness. And this apparent gap between me, the meditator, and emptiness, the object, this apparent duality that seems to be there, in the end, completely collapses. And then we come to a direct realization of emptiness, which is completely non-dualistic, non-conceptual. This is the path of seeing. So in the path of seeing, we now realize emptiness directly. And that now is strong enough to start to wipe out ignorance and mental afflictions in our mind. Previous to that, our emptiness meditation was conceptual, and it was only strong enough to sort of subdue, keep the mental afflictions a little bit under control. Hasn't got rid of anything yet, just keeps the lid on them. But now on the path of seeing, because we've directly realized nature of reality, emptiness, we start to wipe out ignorance and mental afflictions. But one realization of emptiness is not enough to wipe it all out. We have to keep doing that. And that's what we do over the fourth stage, this path of meditation. And those two stages are divided into these 10 segments here called the 10 grounds or 10 bhumis in Sanskrit. And during that path of meditation, we are continually realizing emptiness directly, wiping out more and more ignorance, mental afflictions, until we got to the end of what's called the seventh ground. then we've wiped out all ignorance, all mental afflictions, we've gone completely beyond samsara, we've achieved the goal of nirvana. But since we're on the Mahayana path and we're going to enlightenment, we still got a little bit of work to do. And that is those subtle stains we talked about earlier, yesterday. These subtle stains that are causing this mistaken dualistic appearance in the first place. Over the last three stages, this 8th, 9th, 10th ground, we're wiping out these very subtle stains in our mind. And then at the end of that 10th ground, we wipe out the last stain in our mind. And then the next moment, we're enlightened. And this is this path of no more learning. And at that point, now we see things directly as they are. For us, that's unimaginable because we've only ever seen things in this mistaken dualistic way. Things have never appeared to us in any other way. So for us to comprehend what that would be like would be impossible because we've never had that experience. That's the experience we will have when we're enlightened. So this is super brief, how we progress along in our emptiness practice. Any questions about any of this emptiness things that we've talked about? Because otherwise I'm going to move on in the text. So if there's last questions about any of these.
Seeing things as they are.
So, to see things as they are is to see them as a dependent arising. To see things directly as being merely labeled, as existing within our conceptual framework. But we can't see that now because we have this mistaken dualistic appearance. We can understand intellectually that yes, maybe things exist through cause and conditions and parts and through our conceptual framework. We can sort of understand that. Yet, when we look, they don't appear to be like that. They really do appear to exist from their own side. So when we have that point, then we will see, we will directly see that things are merely labeled. I mean, what that really means, we've never had that experience. So, again, this would be like to try to explain what that would be like, would be like trying to explain what a direct realization of emptiness is like. You know, if we've had a direct realization of emptiness, and we've come out of that, and someone says, what did you realize? Tell me. You'd go, it was sort of like this, sort of like that. Because it's a non-conceptual experience that we're trying to explain through conception or language. It's just impossible. I mean, all we can do is use words that sort of sound... I mean, that's why we hear terms like it's like space. Because emptiness is this absence of independent existence. And, you know, space is the absence of obstruction. So you see things like emptiness is space-like emptiness. But, I mean, that's all we can do is use words to point towards it. We can't describe it directly. So, again, same thing. To describe directly what that would be like, we can't. Because, again, it's beyond duality. It's beyond conception. I mean, all we can do is say that, you know, use words to sort of point to that. That's all we can do.
And I have another question about... imputing and labeling. Now, the pen, if I label the pen, then obviously it's because of my background, because of the
because it's useful, meaningful.
And because I'm a modern day human being and for us it's a pen. And the caveman would then label it as the weapon. But then, without the imputation, there is still something. There is a material base that we are imputing on. And the shape of this material base interests me, because now you said that we are drawing lines, and so the lines that I draw and the caveman draws, are they exactly the same? Did the person who designed the pen and the kind of the material shape of the pen, if you want, did that person kind of define the lines that we see, or does it vary? That of course I understand that the bug would see something not like I wouldn't see a forest from my perspective, but a bird could see the forest. So it depends on the perspective as well. But what interests me is the material shape of this, and then if something, the basis of the imputation still remains there when I walk out of the room, even if, I mean, it's not a pen, but there's materially, there's something there.
Yeah.
What is a line?
Yeah, but yeah, that's exactly. What is a boundary? I mean, can you see a boundary? How wide is a boundary?
The boundary is what, that's because what's interesting is that if I see it as a pen, it's this, and then the caveman would see it as a weapon.
Yeah, but again, you're saying it
has a shape. You know.
We are labeling things.
Yeah. So yeah. Anyway. Yeah. So, I mean, we say it.
Yeah.
That's already labeled.
Mm, exactly.
We've already labeled when we say it.
Yeah.
We've already made, like, I mean, if we go down, we've got billions of atomic particles here.
Okay.
When we say it, we've already grouped billions of atomic particles into one thing. Whether we call it pen or weapon or whatever, we've already done that. So when you already say it, we've labeled it, it's already labeled. We just add another label.
But then why do I label it as...
Because it's meaningful for us, because we need to function.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
That's right.
So then,
it's useful for us.
Yes. So because it's useful for me to shape it as a pen...
As a single thing called a pen, yeah.
But what interests me is now... that I see the lines, because it's...
Well, you can't see a line, actually.
Well, but the shape. But the caveman would see a weapon, you know, because...
Well, maybe. Maybe.
This is something we don't know. Maybe they would see a round shape.
I don't know. I mean, again, it depends on our eye faculty. You know, an ant would see... I mean, an animal through their eyes would see something very different to this, you know.
Mm.
But on that point, you know, we say that it's made up of all these... parts. But if we go down, I mean, what's an atom? Isn't an atom a concept that we've developed as a human to, as a meaningful concept to describe something, describe a reality? So atom's not really a thing, it's a concept, isn't it?
So material, we can't really say materially.
Again, material is a concept that we've developed because
exactly.
It's useful.
So the basis of our imputation.
So we can go down forever.
Yeah, yeah.
There's no bottom. There's no bottom.
So it's also an imputation.
Yeah,
yes.
Of course. Anything else before I move on? I'm stunned. Okay. Let's go on in the text. So now, so far, just to recap then, we've now... just looked at the two practices of shamatha vipassana, the two other main core practices within the Mahayana level. So this verse was talking about how to make our life meaningful for someone of great capacity, meaning this person is not just striving for their own liberation from samsara, from nirvana, but they are striving for the goal of enlightenment to help liberate everyone else from samsara. But then, of course, we can understand that this could take some time to achieve enlightenment. It may take many, many lives, in fact. And then we can go on and think, well, actually, I'm going to do whatever it takes to get to enlightenment as fast as possible so that I can more quickly be of benefit to others. So this would be the motivation for entering into the next level of practice, the Vajrayana, which is also someone of great scope. So that's what's on the next page, or the top of the second page, when it says here, having become a pure vessel by training in the general path. So the general path is everything we've looked at so far. The path striving for a good future, the path striving for nirvana, the path, the Mahayana path, striving for enlightenment. And it says here, having become a pure vessel by training in the general path. So here, what does it mean to be a pure vessel? What does it mean? Vessel here means suitable basis for Vajrayana. So what qualities from the general path do we need to be this pure vessel so we can really enter into the Vajrayana? It said that we need to have three realizations. We need to have three things. We need to have renunciation. So remember, renunciation was this wish for liberation. And then on that basis, we need to expand that further to have this mind of bodhicitta. So we have this aspiration for enlightenment, the entry point to the Mahayana path. And then we also need to have a realization of emptiness. So if we really want to be this pure vessel for the Vajrayana, then again we need to have training in the those three, we need to have experience in those three things. And then it says, to having become a pure vessel by training in the general path, please bless me to enter the holy gateway of the fortunate ones, the supreme Vajra vehicle. So here, of course, Vajra vehicle is Vajrayana. Yana is vehicle. So how do we enter into the Vajrayana? So we said that in the Theravada, the entry point was when we developed this renunciation, the aspiration for liberation. The entry point into the Mahayana path for enlightenment was to develop the aspiration of bodhicitta. So we can talk, actually we can talk about sort of four doors of entry. We can talk about the door of entry into the Dharma in general. So Dharma here, of course, we mean the Buddhist teachings. And so generally, how we enter into the Buddhist teachings is when we take refuge. When we take refuge, of course, into Buddha Dharma Sangha, this really marks the door of entry for us into the Buddhist spiritual path of the Buddhist teachings in general. And so then the door of entry into the Theravada or into the path to Nirvana, of course, is this renunciation, this wish for liberation. The door of entry then into the Mahayana, the path to enlightenment, of course, is this aspiration of bodhicitta. And then the door of entry into the Vajrayana, which we're now talking about, is what's called empowerment or initiation. Where the guru, our qualified teacher of Vajrayana, would introduce us into the Vajrayana practice through this empowerment. So we will then be empowered to engage in this particular practice. So this is really the door of entry. But of course, as we saw in all the lower levels of the practice, the foundation of the practice was ethics. Similarly, in Vajrayana, the foundation of Vajrayana practice is ethics. This is what we see in that second verse here, where it says, at that time, the basis of accomplishing the two attainments is keeping pure vows and samaya. As I have become firmly convinced of this, please bless me to protect these vows and pledges like my life. So we saw that at the foundation level, the initial level of making our life meaningful, then ethical lifestyle, abandoning harming others. We saw at the level of the Theravada, the level of the middling capacity person, striving for nirvana, the basis again there is ethics, in particular these pratimoksha vows to help with that. And then in the Mahayana, of course, the ethics was in particular here the bodhisattva vows to help us support our practice. And here also then in the Tantra or in the Vajrayana, we also have what's called tantric vows to help support us in our practice. And here we have this word samaya. Samaya here is really, again, to have this unshakable bond with the teacher, with the guru, based on these vows. And it says here that these vows and samaya are the basis of accomplishing the two attainments. So the two attainments are the two goals within the Vajrayana. And this word attainment here in Sanskrit is siddhi. So probably you've heard that term. There's in tantric Buddhism, we often hear about the maha siddhas. And maha means great. So a maha siddha, and often they talk about these 84 great maha siddhas of ancient India. And a maha siddha is a great siddha, meaning someone who has great attainments, accomplishments, in Tantra Vajrayana. So here, the two attainments are what's called common or mundane and supreme. Supreme attainment, of course, is the final goal of enlightenment. So someone who's achieved the supreme attainment or supreme siddhi is enlightened. But then we have these what's called common or mundane, which are very certain abilities that someone in the tantric path can develop, you know, like manipulating physical objects, all these sorts of things which we would sort of see as supernormal sort of stuff. These are what's called the common attainments. One of those is extending lifespan, things like this. So these are the common attainments within the Tantra or Vajrayana path. So it says here, please bless me to protect these vows and pledges like my life. So again, the basis of the Tantra Vajrayana is to really protect these vows and pledges. Now, the higher we go in the practice, the more difficult it is to sustain the ethical basis, because the more pure ethics we have to have, the higher we go in the practice. So contrary to popular belief, in Tantra, the ethics here that we're trying to sustain is at a very high level, extremely high level. For example, one of these tantric vows that we're trying to sustain is that if we give up love for even one single sentient being, this is considered a serious ethical downfall at this level of practice. That's the sort of ethics we're trying to hold in Tantra or Vajrayana. Again, contrary to popular belief where people often think that I'm doing tantric practice, so I'm beyond ethics, I can do whatever I want because I'm arising as the deity, so all my actions are pure. Doesn't matter what I do. This is a disaster. So this is what we have as the basis for our practice here in the Vajrayana. Then we go on, it says here, then having realized the importance of the two stages, the essence of the Vajrayana, by practicing with great energy, never giving up the four sessions, please bless me to realize the teachings of the Holy Guru. So here, of course, on the basis of ethics, we're talking about the training. Now, here it talks about the two stages, and it says that's the essence of the Vajrayana. Now, in the Vajrayana, or Tantra, we can talk about four classes or four levels of Vajrayana practice. The first level of tantric practice is called Action Tantra or Kriya Tantra. And in Kriya Tantra, and this is sort of like the very easy introductory level into Tantra, at this level of practice, there's much more of an emphasis on what's called external yoga, external activities, because it's much easier to work with external things than to, with the mind, of course. So here, at this level, there's a lot of emphasis on like cleanliness, food we eat and how we sleep and so forth. So here, particularly in Kriya Tantra, you'll see things like black foods. They talk about these black foods like these onions and garlic and so forth because it's said that these foods can agitate the mind. So they have a lot of this sort of external activities as part of their practice because it's a lot easier to work with this than the subtle mind. Then the next level of tantra is called performance tantra. Which is Charya Tantra. Here in Charya Tantra, performance tantra, there's sort of an equal emphasis on external and internal yoga. Then the next level is called Yoga Tantra, now there's a more emphasis on internal yoga, internal practice. And then the highest level is called Highest Yoga Tantra. Or Anuttara Yoga Tantra. Here, there's a complete emphasis on inner yoga, inner practice. And when we talk about here the essence of the Vajrayana is the two stages, this is what we're talking about. So the two stages practices is this level of practice. And it's at this level of practice that we take these tantric vows. So often then, and within Tibetan Buddhism, you don't see a lot of practices at these two levels. You generally just see practices at these two levels. So here in the Action Tantra level, Kriya Tantra level, there is no tantric vows involved. And often the practice here is quite a simple practice of visualizing the deity, imagining some light being absorbed in and chanting some mantras. So this is sort of a bit of a familiarization with tantric practice. Whereas here, the empowerment we're talking about here includes then these tantric vows and then it includes these two stages practices, which we looked at the other day. Which were generation stage and completion stage. So remember, the whole purpose of this Vajrayana practice is to accelerate the spiritual path to enlightenment by gaining access to a deeper level of our mind, trying to gain access to the deepest level of our mind called this very subtle mind of clear light, primordial mind, given many different names. And we can gain access to that through these two stages. The generation stage practice often involves following a practice manual called a sadhana. Where we go through various visualizations and absorptions, and also again often involves chanting mantra and various other activities. And of course, this generation stage practice is again the tantra practice is again called the resultant vehicle, because we are doing the practice from the perspective of the result. So within this practice, we are doing the whole practice visualizing ourselves in a fully enlightened form. That's why to do that well, we need this. Because we need to really be arising as the deity out of emptiness and not somehow simply pretending me, I'm pretending to be Chenrezig. Then we've missed the point. Because there is no solid me here pretending to be a solid independent Chenrezig. So we need to really have an appreciation of emptiness and really dissolve this appearance, this ordinary appearance of me into emptiness, and then arise as the deity out of emptiness for this practice to be effective. At a more subtle level, this generation stage practice involves developing a high level of focus, shamatha practice. You know, at the earlier level of practice, we talked about shamatha practice yesterday, focusing on the nostrils, on the breath at the nostrils, or focusing on the mind or some other object. Generally here, in generation stage practice, often we talk about, you know, within a particular tantric practice, we talk about what's called a mandala. A mandala is like a pure form of the environment of that deity. And that can involve many other deities, many other things in that environment, a very complex environment that we're often trying to visualize here. Often at this level of the practice, we're trying to imagine that whole environment, this big, this size, in some particular point here. This is our object of shamatha. Not so easy. So we need to develop this high level of focus here, because in completion stage practice, we are trying to gain access to this very subtle clear light mind. To do that, we have to cause the heart chakra to open, because to allow the very subtle clear light mind to become active. To do that, of course, we have to withdraw all the subtle energies into the central channel and bring them all to the heart chakra. To do that, we need this very high level of focus. So completion stage practice is manipulating subtle energies in the subtle body and withdrawing them to the heart chakra, causing the heart, the very subtle clear light mind to come out active, and then using that to realize emptiness. So completion stage practice is vipassana practice. So we can see here also in Tantra and Vajrayana, the basis is ethics, and then the two core practices are shamatha and vipassana. So at all levels of practice, same three core elements, ethics, concentration, wisdom. So these are the two stages that are mentioned here in the text. And it says that we should practice with great energy, never giving up the four sessions. Please bless me to realize the teachings of the Holy Guru. So here the four sessions is that generally in retreat mode, you would... your daily schedule would be to do four sessions each day, and in each session you would do the complete sadhana practice in each of those four sessions. And one session, depending on how long the sadhana is, could take 2, 3, 4 hours, depending on how big that the practice is. Uh, Any questions on that?
It's a very trivial question, but I mean, if you are practicing Tantra, do you actually have time to do any other practices, or are they necessary at that point?
So, of course, in the ideal situation, you have this. And so if you have this, then, you know, all the things are included there, really. If you don't have this, of course, or they're not very strong, then, of course, we need to make sure that we have, as the basis of our practice, we put some effort into these elements as well, of course. Otherwise, it's not going to work. Of course, here the four sessions is we're talking in a retreat setting, you know. Normally, someone who has this practice would do it sort of maybe once on a daily basis, depending on what sort of commitments we have from our teacher. That would depend. So again, I think that if we've really got to this level of the practice in the correct way, then we probably would be devoting quite many hours a day to this practice. And also you'll find that at this level of practice, often people can even, you know, go without much sleep at all. Not like us. We try to cut the sleep and we're just spaced out. But, you know, often here, then people are doing also what's called dream yoga and so forth. And so they're actually doing practice in the lucid dreams and so forth. So, I mean, there's many ways we can do this sort of practice at that level. If, of course, we haven't really got that, then we need to, of course, make sure that we're continuing to do the foundations. Because, unfortunately, what happens is that, you know, people see this and it seems really like interesting or the shortcut to enlightenment, and so then they sort of just jump straight in here without any of the foundation. And, you know, I know a few friends of mine who've for many years have been just rattling off this sadhana every day, and after 10 years they don't seem to have really changed much at all. And I think the reason is they don't really have the basis, and they're just going rattling through this thing as quickly as possible to tick it off, and I think that's not really going to give us much benefit.
So how do you even know? I mean, I'm not really interested in
doing this. Sure. Well,
how
yes.
How do you know?
Exactly. Really? So historically, these things here, you would never hear about until your teacher saw that you were quite well practiced in these three things, and then your teacher, if they were qualified in Tantra Vajrayana, would say, now I think it's time for you to begin something in Tantra. Before that, you would not even ever hear about it.
But nowadays,
well, nowadays it's unfortunately degenerated a little bit.
How would you know?
Again, I mean, I think if we're serious in terms of wanting to do something effective here, we need to have a personal teacher, we need to ask them. I mean, really, to try and do this without a personal teacher, I think we're not going to get very far. I mean, it's okay. I mean, if we have the right motivation and we try our best, then sure, that's okay. But is that going to be the most effective use of our time? Maybe not. I mean, maybe it's better to more effectively use our time at the foundation level. Maybe we'll progress better. Of course, it won't be a waste of time to do this if we do try our best and have a good motivation, but we don't have unlimited time and energy. You know, we'd like to sort of make our practice as effective as possible, and that's why a personal, qualified personal teacher can do that for us. They can really tailor it and say, you know, maybe it's good for you to really focus on shamatha now, or some bodhicitta or emptiness practice or something else. And then maybe, you know, just don't put too much effort on that now because it's not going to give you much, and focus more on the foundation practices and then later put more effort into that. That's where a qualified teacher can really help. Sure.
As someone to whom all this is really very new, could you
Yeah. Well, the word yoga means to yoke. It means to sort of put together. And the word yoga in Buddhism, coming through the Tibetan, is nel jaw. Nel means the actual state, and jaw means to join, to yoke. So yoga in Buddhism means to join to reality. So any practice that brings us to connect to reality is yoga. And that can be the yoga of eating, the yoga of meditating. These are all yoga in that sense. But of course, in our modern society, when we talk about yoga, we're talking about one small aspect of the yoga system, which is the asanas, you know, the physical body work. So even in the yoga system, there are many levels of yoga. But generally, we're only pointing at one of those, which is the asana work, the physical body work. Yeah. So again, when you see the word yoga in Buddhist texts, particularly Tibetan Buddhist texts, that's the meaning, is to join to reality, to join to basically emptiness. So any practice that either directly or indirectly brings you there can be called yoga.
Is there any way within this practice which helps to develop the foundation?
Yeah, of course, it's not a one-way system in any of this, and you'll find there'll be this sort of feedback thing happening that, you know, the more you, for instance, develop the loving-kindness and compassion and tonglen, that will feed even back into your shamatha practice and so forth. So there is this interplay, but we need to make sure that we have a solid foundation as we move up. The analogy I often give there is like, you know, building a three-story building, you know. And so, like, trying to do this without doing any of the foundation work would be like saying, build me the third floor penthouse, but I don't want the first two floors. Just don't build those, okay? I don't want them. I mean, it's not going to work. But saying that as well is that, you know, do we have to 100% finish the first floor before we begin the second one? No, but we have to have a minimum structure there to support the second level. And then while we're working on the second level, we can keep working at the first level and make it more complete. And then the same, when the second level is at a certain stage, we can begin the third level and then continue working at the second level. So it's a little bit like that. So we need a certain minimum level to be able to effectively move work at the next level. Like, you know, bodhicitta is really sort of based on renunciation. So renunciation, of course, is really compassion for ourselves. If we don't really have any renunciation, then trying to develop bodhicitta is going to be difficult, extremely difficult. But do we have to have 100% renunciation to begin the bodhicitta practice? No. But if we put effort at the foundation, then the next level is going to be easier to work with. But then, of course, they will feed back on them. So there will be that effect as well. Again, how to know when and what and what. This is where a qualified teacher can be most effective in tailoring and how much of this and how much of that and so forth. That's where the teacher is really helpful. Because again, we don't have unlimited time and energy, and we want to be as effective as possible in whatever we do. And at our level, it's hard to know, you know, should I do this much of this and this much of that, or should I do this or that? It's not, I mean, of course they're all good, but I mean, we want to be as effective as possible in our practice. And so that's where the teacher can really tailor that for us.
I mean, if one way to tell which practice you should do is that if you are drawn to some practice, or the opposite?
No, I mean, drawn, there's a difference between drawn and having attachment. So, yes, I mean, it's helpful, of course. If we're really drawn to a particular practice, it means we have some aspiration to do the practice, which means we can put more effort into it. So that's good, that's good. But just having an attachment going, wow, that practice looks really exciting and mystical and I want to do that.
And if you enjoy doing the practice, is that good?
Yeah, I mean, we should have enjoyment, but there's a difference between joyous effort and attachment, of course. I mean, joyous effort we need. We need joyous effort in all the practices. And joyous effort comes from understanding the practice and the benefits from doing the practice. And then we can joyfully do the practice even if it's difficult, because we understand that it's going to really bring some benefit. Yeah, and we should use our natural talents in the spiritual path. If we've got some natural talent and ability, we should harness that. And again, if we have a qualified teacher, they would see that and they would tailor that so that we can draw on our natural talents and abilities so that we can maximize the benefit and effectiveness of our practice. Yes, absolutely. Okay. So then we just come, that finishes then the Tantra Vajrayana level of the practice. And then we just have two verses at the end here. The first one says, like that, may the gurus who show the noble path and the spiritual friends who practice it have long lives. So that's just again, establishing a connection with the teacher. So, you know, we talk about, the necessity or the advantages of having a personal teacher. And then often people hear this expression like, you know, when you're ready, the teacher will appear, you know. And then people have this idea that they'll be lying on their sofa at home, sipping their coffee, there'll be a knock on the door, they'll open the door and there'll be a person with a halo around their head saying, I'm here. So I think if this is our idea, might be waiting for quite a long time for that knock on the door. So yes, it is true that when you're ready, a teacher will appear, but what when you're ready means to make heartfelt aspirational prayers to meet a teacher, and then to actually, on top of that, search for a teacher. Then you might find one. So, you know, often people, particularly in Tibetan Buddhism, there's a lot of these sort of prayers and so forth, and people will go, oof, I'm not doing those prayer things, you know. But we need to understand what a prayer means. A prayer here in Buddhism is not praying that, oh, Buddha, please fix me or sort out my problems. Of course, those sorts of prayers are not so helpful. But rather, if we're praying to our teacher to, like this, bless me, you know, bless me, inspire me, help me to be able to do this. This is useful. And then also these sort of prayers here, like asking to, may I meet qualified teacher. This will really plant a very powerful imprint in our mind to almost by magic sometimes find that teacher. Because it really, you know, what we, you know, there's a quote I think I mentioned the other day, what we attend to becomes our reality. So if we're attending to this aspiration to meet a qualified teacher, this really programs us to really sort of almost by magic move in ways that will find a teacher. So I think if we really want a teacher, this is really going to be part of it, is to really have that deep aspiration to meet a teacher. And then it goes here, it says, please bless me to pacify completely all outer and inner hindrances. So again, to have that inspiration and guidance from the teacher to help, so that he can help, he or she can help inspire you and guide you to overcome any obstacles, whether they're outer or inner obstacles in the spiritual path. And then in the last verse it says, in all my lives, never separated from perfect gurus, may I enjoy the magnificent Dharma. So here again is this aspirational prayer to continue to meet teachers in this life and in future lives. And then by completing the qualities of the stages and the paths, so stages and paths we can talk about here in the Mahayana, the various stages and paths, may I quickly attain a state of Vajradhara. Vajradhara here is like the tantric form of Buddha, of enlightened being. And so that's the finish of the text. So any last questions on the text? Yeah.
Can I ask about the teacher? Because I just heard a little while ago Joan Reko actually mentioned it, that the teacher is somebody you just label to be your teacher in your own mind. You don't have to go and say hello, do you want to be my teacher? But you hear somebody and you think in your own mind that this person is the teacher.
Of course, everyone and everything can be your teacher. And I think these sorts of prayers also open the mind such that, because often we have this preconceived idea, the teacher's going to look like this, they're going to be this sort of and then we sort of cut out the possibility of, we may actually meet someone who's really a qualified teacher, but because they don't fit our preconceived idea, we just sort of ignore them. But actually, as you said, everyone and everything can be our teacher. And often in particularly these early Tibetan teachings, the Lojong teachings, we hear these stories of in fact, the most person who treats you worst is your best teacher. Like the famous story of Lama Atisha, who came to Tibet and introduced this Lam Rim teachings. When he came to Tibet, he brought with himself an attendant who was completely obnoxious, a really horrible person. And when he came, the Tibetans sort of looked at this person and said to Lama Atisha, why did you bring him? Why did you get someone who's, very helpful and kind and so forth? And he told the Tibetans, this person is my most holy teacher. And he picked him for that purpose. So, of course, at our level, we don't need to go and search out for these sorts of people. We have enough difficulties in general. But actually, as we progress in the spiritual path, we're going to need to find these sorts of people, because otherwise we can't progress. If everyone's really nice to us, how do we develop patience? We can't. We can only develop patience if people are testing us. So, therefore, at all levels of practice, everyone can be our teacher. But I think on top of that, what we're talking about here is a personal teacher who can give us personal advice and guidance. This is really, I think, helpful. If we can really find such a person, they can really make our practice much more effective, help us to overcome obstacles, all of these sorts of things, because we don't have unlimited time and we want to be as effective as possible. And at our level, it's difficult for us to know which practices to do and in what measure and so forth to be effective. And so this is where the personal teacher can be helpful. How to establish that relationship, of course, a number of different ways. Often in the Tibetan tradition, it's like a sort of a formal thing, make a formal request. And again, often the Tibetan tradition is to refuse three times. So often as a Westerner, people go and, can you be my teacher? No. Oh, okay. And then they go away. Because I think it's the sort of refusing three times is like, if you're really sincere, you'll persevere. If you're just sort of doing it not with sincerity, then, I think it's a bit to weed out people who are not really sincere. But anyway, that seems to be the Tibetan tradition often, that in terms of asking them to teach and to be the teacher, the tradition often says that they should refuse three times. I want to say something more about that now, I forgot. Oh, so yes, it can be a formal thing, or it can also be a little bit more organic. We need to check out the teacher. And so one way, effective way of checking them out, of course, is if they're in your area, is to go to their teachings, their general teachings, and sit there and listen and so forth. And then maybe even somehow get to know the teacher a little bit and talk to them a little bit. And so then you start to get to know the teacher a bit. And then at some point, it can just more or less organically get to the point where, okay, now I think, can you be my teacher sort of thing in a more informal way. So how you do that can be a number of different ways. But, I think also in the text it often talks about, how many personal teachers should we have? And generally the answer is one. I mean, it's okay to go to a number of different teachers to get general teachings, but when it comes to personal advice, it's often recommended to have one teacher, personal teacher. For the reason, well, there's a couple of reasons. One good reason is that, you know, often if we go to the teacher for personal instruction, the one piece of advice they'll probably give us, or often give us, is the one thing we don't want to do because it's the one thing we've been avoiding because it's the one thing we really need to do. So often then they'll say, do this, and we go, oh, no, I don't want to do that. But it's really what we should do. And then we don't like that, so we run off to another teacher and ask them. And then we keep doing that until we find a teacher that says something nice and we go, oh, yeah, I'll do that. This is not helpful to us. And then often, of course, if we do that, if we go to a teacher for personal advice, and then they often will ask you, do you have a personal teacher? And if you say yes, they will simply say, do what they told you to do. Yeah. And I think also, from my personally anyway, if you have a personal teacher and you go to ask for advice, don't ask for advice unless you're prepared to follow it, because otherwise we're not being sincere. You know, often people go for advice, they get something difficult, and they go, I'm not going to do that. I think this is not really good for us. Of course, if the advice they offer to us we believe to be somehow unethical, then we must not do it, of course. But if we're really having a personal teacher and we really want personal advice, my personal opinion at least is if you ask for advice, you better be prepared to follow it. Otherwise, don't ask, because it's not no help. You know, we're just kidding ourselves, I think. Okay. Anything else? Otherwise, I've just got a few things to say to wrap up this evening. Okay. So we've gone through this foundation of all good qualities, again from Lama Tsongkhapa, and this is this sort of like a lam rim prayer, really, that just touches on some of the main points of the whole lam rim path. So I think it's good, of course, if we're following this lam rim structure, to get teachings, in-depth teachings on these various aspects of the lam rim. And of course, in the center and so forth, we have a lot of these books available for lam rim. I mean, the main text that Lama Tsongkhapa wrote, the most extensive, was this Lam Rim Chenmo, this great treatise on the stages of the path to enlightenment. So that's sort of the most extensive text we have available for following this Lam Rim. And then he wrote a middling length one and a few others, and there's other commentaries available. So I think it can be very helpful to read such books and get teachings, more in-depth teachings on the various topics in this Lam Rim. In terms of then more extensive courses to follow, then of course, and I think some of you have already done this, within this tradition, within this FPMT organization, then every year in Kopan Monastery in outside of Kathmandu, there's the November course, which is a one-month course on the Lam Rim, which involves teachings, meditations, and so forth. And I think Mikko and a few other people, Susanna, have followed this November course, so if you're interested in that, I'm sure they can answer lots of questions about that. I myself am also running a 10-day Lam Rim course in California later this year. So if you're in California, pop along. If not, I'm planning to put the audio for that on my website. GlennSvensson.org. So already have quite a lot of audio from various courses on that site, and lots of materials and lots of charts and that. So whatever you find there, just help yourself. And also I've got a contact page on there, so if you want to ask me any questions about anything, then please feel free to send me a message and I'll try and answer any questions you have. And that's about it, I think. That's all I wanted to really say. Any last questions before we finish up this evening?
Maybe some
confused thing, because the infamous is the old game kun mä viittasin sellaiseen moraalikohtaan tuolla aikaisemmin, että ettei saisi hetkeksikään luopua tästä kaudesta.
Earlier you mentioned there is a point that one should never give up love for even a moment towards any sentient being.
Well, that was one of the tantric vows.
Yes, in Kampokas book on loving kindness, he mentioned three objects or three.
Elävät olennot ja ilmiöt ja sitten vaivan kohdetta.
Sentient beings and phenomena and then no objects.
So, what this is, and this is often also you'll find this similarly in Chandrakirti, when he talks about compassion. He talks about compassion to all sentient beings and then to what's called phenomena, or it gives different names, and then no objectless or something. What this is talking about is having compassion or loving kindness at three levels of wisdom. The first is that now we have grasping, me, you. And so we grasp onto independent me, independent other. So at our level, we try to develop loving kindness or compassion to ourselves and others based on this self-grasping mind. So that's the first one. The second one is to have loving kindness and compassion to ourselves and others based on the understanding of impermanence. So that's what means phenomena, or I think in Chandrakirti he calls it something different. And the third one, where it says no object or objectless, or there's again a couple of different terms, is to have loving kindness and compassion for ourselves and others based on the realization of emptiness. Because there's no object, there's no independent me, independent other. So these three levels are based on our levels of wisdom. The first one simply was self-grasping. Second one was a realization of impermanence. And the third one is based on a realization of emptiness. Anything else anyone would like to add? Otherwise we'll slowly finish up. Okay. So then to finish, I'd just like to thank Mikko and everyone else who helped organize this event and set up everything and look after me. Thank you very much for that. And I'd also like to thank all of you, of course, for making the time and putting the energy into coming here this weekend and this evening. And I hope you really got something out of this weekend, and I hope to be back again next year sometime. So.